This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. So you've been working at home for a year, and you have an exhausting line of back-to-back Zoom meetings. You have outside distractions and real-world interruptions that you never had at the office. Your kids, your grandkids, the dog, the cat, the lawnmower or snowblower next door, the neighbor knocking on your door. It makes getting work done more challenging. On the other hand, your commute is gone. You see your family more, and you have unexpected moments of lightness, an impromptu walk around the block, or a conversation about dinner. And you actually eat dinner together. Imagine that. The pandemic has forced us all to rethink our work and home lives and appreciate new facets of the workforce that we took for granted for so long. Now going back to a windowless office 5 days a week from 9 to 5 seems out of place. So what will the future of work look like? Someone who has pondered that thought is Sandy Barua. He's president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Hi, Sandy.
Great to be with you.
Joining us as well is Dustin Walsh. He's a reporter with Crain's Detroit Business. Dustin, welcome back.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start by asking you both what your workspace has looked like this past year. Dustin?
Well, when I can keep my kids out of it, I do have an office. My wife actually remodeled it. She kind of got the home remodeling bug. So it's actually really quite nice. I have bookshelves and, I'm pretty comfortable in here now.
Sandy, how about you?
Yeah, so we're very fortunate. We bought the house that we're currently in Grosse Pointe Park about 6 years ago, and it came with a lovely den with a big bay window with a nice view of the backyard. And now for the last year, I've actually been using it.
So how easily has your work translated to the all digital office, Sandy?
Fortunately, we were prepared. We had our first all hands meeting about this thing called COVID, kind of like, I think it was like the 23rd of February of 2020. And we already started implementing protocols in the office back then. So by the time we had to do the hard pivot to you're going home and you're staying home, you know, we were all prepared. We had the technology, both hardware and software. And I remember telling the team right before we left, I said, listen, guys, be prepared. This thing could last for weeks.
I don't mean to laugh, but it seems so quaint now, doesn't it?
So I've been reminded, I never clarified exactly how many weeks it would last. So
right.
So far, I'm still correct.
Sandy, what sectors proved to be lifesavers, economic lifesavers or just personal lifesavers during the pandemic? I'm thinking of, you know, two-day home delivery and Zoom connections.
Yeah, certainly, you know, if our society hadn't developed the technology that we have developed to this point, I think this pandemic would have been, you know, far, far different and frankly, far more painful than it has been. You know, from an economic standpoint, obviously, most of the service sector was hit incredibly hard. In fact, I think it's up to like 42% of service sector workers were negatively impacted by COVID. Obviously, if you're in the business of, you know, food delivery, food, you know, grocery shelf stocker, you had a very dangerous job. But manufacturing, and very much unlike previous recessionary periods in Michigan, manufacturing has been our savior, and usually manufacturing is our Achilles heel. And that is one of the reasons why Michigan is poised incredibly well, perhaps even better than a lot of our national peers, to really accelerate out of this particular economic downturn.
You know, you have talked a lot in the past about the role of automation and how economies expand and contract and adjust to new technology, that when one door closes in the workforce, another will eventually open, which is really an optimist's view of jobs in the economy. Were there things that presented themselves over the past year that gave you pause, weaknesses that you didn't anticipate, or areas that need some adjustment for the future strength of our economy?
You know, it's a great question, you know, in terms of what we anticipated. I don't want to say I was smart enough to anticipate what was going to happen. Remember, I'm the guy who stood up in front of our entire team of 80 people and said, you know, a year ago, hey, this could last weeks, right? So, you know, little did I know that I'd still be in my den over a year later. So no soothsayer am I. But I will say that, you know, what has been surprising to me is really the resilience of just our national economy and our Michigan economy. You know, if you look at the numbers, it is not what you would have expected at all. I mean, just, you know, if you want to look broadly, look at the stock market, right? Look at housing values. Frankly, look at unemployment. You know, right now we are less than 10% of total employment than we were prior to the pandemic started, and considering all the pain and sacrifice society has been through, you know, that ain't half bad, right? So there's been a lot of surprises coming out of this, and I think we've learned a lot, and hopefully we'll heed the lessons that we've learned.
Dustin, as Sandy was talking about manufacturing, we've been moving from a making things economy to a service-based economy for a few decades now. But the pandemic showed that this precariousness of service and lots of face-to-face interaction has some weak points. Something like a pandemic exposed that fragility, right? Is there a flaw in these economic structures we've slowly developed to have moved so decidedly away from making things into providing services?
I mean, of course. And so we also have to remember things don't move in a linear path. These multifaceted parts of our economy don't move in a linear path with each other, right? They're not all parallel. So yes, we've transitioned to a service economy in some sectors. We still have a really strong manufacturing sector here. Yes, automation and technology impacts jobs in one sector and then creates jobs in another, but that doesn't necessarily happen overnight. And so there's pain in between. So we sort of have all those issues arising. And I think another thing to really remember about manufacturing, as Sandy pointed out, that it was, you know, did quite well, but in the history, well, since 1979 was the last time that manufacturing employment ever actually fully recovered from this before a recession till after a recession. So the odds that we will have the same amount of manufacturing jobs we had in January 2020 ever again is probably pretty slim. And so that sort of shows the progression going one way. And obviously the service sector may never recover the way it did, to jobs before the pandemic, because it's exposed, as you said, those flaws. So I think there's cracks in it. The long question is going to be, what do those people then transition into? Do they get stronger education? Do they create jobs in certain other sectors that may, you know, transition easy for them? I mean, that's the great, you know, sort of challenge is the people that get spit out of one industry, where do we put them in the next? And does the state or businesses, what role do they play in advancing the careers of those people?
Sandy, do you see an area of growth that would be natural to transition some of that away from service to something else?
Yeah, I mean, Dustin is so spot on in his analysis there, because, you know, new jobs always get created. I mean, when we move from the agrarian society to the manufacturing society, when we move from essentially the manufacturing society to the technology society and information society, always, always, always new jobs get created. But the point that Dustin is bringing up is absolutely critical, which is, you know, are the people who are being displaced in the sectors that are dwindling, will they have a home in the new sectors that are created? And I think we can safely say now that our society is not equipped for those people to make that transition very successfully, because as old jobs get destroyed, those are primarily jobs that require less education, less skill, and they are replaced with jobs that require substantially more education and skill. So if you lose your job, you know, say as an entry-level manufacturing worker, you're not automatically equipped to go do something in the high-tech field, which may be scrambling for workers. So, you know, we're seeing this, and Dustin and I both talked about this at length. You know, we have this K-shaped economy that has really been created and that COVID has accelerated, where people with skills, people with resources are thriving, and they've thrived throughout COVID. In fact, household wealth, according to the Federal Reserve Bank, has never been higher at $130.2 trillion. But we still have a segment of society that is frankly almost growing that is doing worse and worse. So we're getting, you know, essentially it's the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking right now with Sandy Barua. He's the president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber, and Dustin Walsh. He's a reporter with Crain's Detroit Business. Dustin, you wrote about how the best boost to the economy coming out of the pandemic will be returning to the office. But in the same article and in the same breath almost, you also wrote that going back to the office 5 days a week seems senseless at this point. It provides for less work-life balance and is harder on the environment and infrastructure. What do we know about how work-from-homers, if you will, are feeling about work coming out of the pandemic?
Right, and that's the difficulty of it all. The reality is, if you want to, as Sandy was talking about, the K-shaped economy, which, by the way, are largely women and minorities. If you want to help those people out, your neighbors that are in the bottom part of that K, the smartest thing you can do is to get vaccinated as soon as humanly possible and get back into the office, because the stats, you know, speak for themselves. That would cause the economy to recover at a much quicker pace. At the same time, people that are working from home do not want that overwhelmingly. They do not want to go back to the office 5 days a week. And so how do you sort of fix that, right? And there's a lot of things that are probably going to change. Employers are going to want workers back in the office, at least part-time. You're going to see some transition there on how many hours they want them in the office. I think you're going to see employers looking to cut pay for people that don't want to be in the office because, you know, hey, you're at home. You don't have to, you know, pay for a second car or gas or this. So maybe, you know, economically it works out better for you to take a little less money. And so it's a hard thing to rectify, right? Because working from home is going to have a shift on the economy. It's going to be slow. Like, will the restaurants in Detroit move maybe closer into some of the other suburbs where a lot of people are working from home? Maybe, but that doesn't happen overnight. And so that's sort of where there's going to be these pockets of joblessness that may not recover depending on whether people decide to go back to the office.
So, Sandy, we've spent, I don't know, lifetimes watching Europeans live some sort of work-life balance that seems to inspire a sense of how do they do it? But, you know, it's what we prioritize. And as Americans, we have long prioritized hard, thankless work in many cases. And maybe the pandemic has shifted some of that general thinking for ourselves. So how do CEOs balance the needs of the economy with the needs of workers who are doubtlessly all rethinking what the totality of their lives looks like?
Well, I think it's really important for all of us to take a breath and realize that even though we've been in this over a year, we're still kind of in the middle end of it, and this hasn't ended yet. And the reason why I say that is that in the middle of a crisis is a terrible time to predict how we're going to behave post-crisis. So, you know, Sandy's saying on crises is that we never change as much as we think we will, but we never change as much as we probably should. So there's a lot of variables out there. Number one is, you know, workplace culture. One of the reasons why, you know, there's a lot of talk about, oh yeah, we're really going to, you know, we're really going to double down on this remote workplace, is that, you know, for the most part, the teams that organizations started with a year ago are the teams that we have today. So we are using Zoom and electronic communications to continue relationships and a culture that was already built. As time goes on and those people change out, you know, you're going to want to ensure that you can build a workplace culture. And that's really hard to do electronically. It's hard to build new relationships over electronic means. And you really need to read body language. You need to go to lunch together. You know, you need to kind of have those personal in-person interactions. You know, regarding office space, right, there's a lot of talk. Dustin and his colleagues, Kurt, have written about office space, especially in the Detroit region. You know, I've talked to employers and say, yeah, you know, we're not going to necessarily have people back 5 days a week. That's kind of a given. Our people won't stand for it. However, you know, when they are in the office, they're going to want more space. So we might see a return to more individualized office space as opposed to the kind of a lot of the bullpen settings that have been created. And as time goes on, you know, as work from home becomes a little bit more kind of routine and not quite novel, you know, we're gonna see issues around productivity and efficiency that can probably only be gained by some sort of return to in-person working together, just like you see losses of efficiency in remote learning.
So, Sandy, just anecdotally, how are you approaching the transition to allowing people to have a bit more autonomy, maybe, but also ensuring that you have a workplace culture that is in person and produces the type of lightning in a bottle moments that can only happen when you have two people in a room together?
Yeah, we're going to do both, right? We're going to certainly allow people and on our team more flexibility to work from home, you know, less standard working hours. I mean, people are going to be able to choose a greater degree of, you know, I want to be in the office, you know, these 3 days, or I want to be in the office only in the mornings. But I'm definitely going to engineer a day or two where most of those, you know, 1 or 2 days, we have our entire staff in the office to ensure that there is some overlap for things like all hands meetings and things like that, but still allow people, you know, the flexibility to do that. And frankly, as an employer, if I didn't do that, you know, my employees, you know, and fellow team members would say, well, you know, forget this. If this boss is going to make me come in, you know, 9 to 5, 5 days a week, I'm going to find an employer that's, you know, much more enlightened. So it's going to be in the employer's interest to respond to what their employees are asking for.
So do you think that there will be many organizations, larger organizations, that will say, yep, as soon as you're vaccinated, we're going right back to where we were before? Or do you think that it's pretty across the board that changes are going to happen?
That's largely going to, based on surveys that we've seen, and Sandy might be able to back this up, but it's going to divide politically, what side of the political line you are on, how you feel about the virus. The employers that are owners of companies that tend to sort of not buy into the virus and don't really think it is a thing or been harmed maybe by some of the shutdown orders from the governor or the health department, they may force people to come back simply because they don't buy into it. And so I think you're going to see just sort of a divide, and a lot of it's going to be on political lines. That's a reality of what may happen. And you know, we're going to see whether employees do in fact revolt against that. I think you're going to see some of that too.
Dustin Walsh is a reporter with Crain's Detroit Business, and Sandy Barua is president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Thanks to you guys both, and good luck in slowly working back to whatever the new normal is in your office.
Thank you.
Great to be with you both.